Welcome to episode 61 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I teach online classes about paper, light, and books. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today I'm talking with Beatrice Caron, a French-born artist who has been living and working in New York City for more than 30 years. I met Beatrice at the Center for Book Arts in New York City when we both took classes and participated in events there in the 1990s. We talk about how Beatrice developed her unique paper cutting style, which has gotten her everything from illustration gigs to public art commissions in other materials based on her paper cuts. She discusses her favorite papers and cutting knife and how she goes back and forth between hand cutting and design on the computer.
Sometimes you're like, oh, that will save me a lot of time if I start from the computer, because I can flip and cut and paste and repeat and put the thing so I can see the composition and then I can rearrange. And then after, I sometimes try on the computer and I cannot start because my lines are dead. Mm-hmm. There is not something, it doesn't go further. So I have to go back to a cutting. And with a cutting, sometimes I begin, because of course, when I'm doing something, I have no idea where I'm going. So I just have to start and get a feeling that I recognize something where I want to go.
A theme that seems consistent in her work is how one thing leads to another. Here's an example. When a show at the Museum of Art and Design inspired her, she contacted the curator, which led to her being a consultant on their paper cut exhibition, Slashed, Under the Knife. And she was also an artist in residence during that show. Someone from Alliance Française saw that show and, since Beatrice is French, invited her to give a talk there, where she met another person who invited her to give a TED talk. And the story keeps unfolding. By the way, Beatrice designed and wore an amazing paper cut cape when she gave that TED talk. You'll find a link to that in the show notes. Enjoy our conversation. Beatrice Caron, welcome to Paper Talk. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you're in New York City, right in the heart of COVID-19. It's April 28th, 2020. How is it going there? What is your life like?
My life in the studio, it's about the same as usual, because I still have the same routine and I'm pretty by myself in the studio all the time.
Right.
Of course, outside is completely different. And there is a lot of sirens from the firemen, the ambulance. The first days were very eerie, as you had completely empty New York.
Right.
And on weekend, I went biking. So you see Times Square empty. And it looks like a really bad science fiction movie. Dystopian. Yeah. And then after, you know, it's a reality. So it's before and after. It's a rupture time in history.
Yeah, for sure. And what about, I know you go jogging in Central Park. Have you noticed, like, from the beginning until now, are there more people out, or is it?
There is much more people out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The first time I was still doing the same thing every day. Mm-hmm. And the beginning, it was nearly nobody. Mm-hmm. And when they began to have stay at home, you know, and the thing, and to bike in New York, there were nearly no car at all and nobody. And now you have more cars and more people out biking and walking and jogging. And in fact, on weekend, there is too many people in the park. Mm. So I only go biking in the streets.
Right.
Because there is, and there are people that they still go outside, but they're completely freaking out because it's there is a lot of space in the park, but people will get very nervous, like, you don't have your mask, or you know, even they're like 10 feet away. And yeah. So you have all the fear factor and the things of social isolation is never good for the mind.
Right. Well, I'm glad you can get out, and this episode won't air for a couple of months, so let's hope that things are more back to normal by then.
The new normal.
The new normal, that's right. They won't be the same. Yeah. So you're from France. Tell me a little bit about growing up there and creativity and how you ended up in New York City.
So I don't have a great memory. So I know I have very few memories from my childhood. Mm-hmm. Basically, it was middle class in Lyon, and only child. Mm-hmm. And basically, I remember I was bored, and I was bored, and I was bored.
Yeah.
And that's about all I remember. I was bored. I could be good at school if I got interested in something. And then after, I was just dreaming away and looking at the sky, and suddenly they have your name to go and do something.
Right, so you weren't challenged, it sounds like.
No,
there I was not. No challenge. Uh-huh.
So I was kind of, where'd that come from? Uh-huh. So I was good at escaping and making stories and making my own little world.
Uh-huh. And how did you end up in New York City?
So I tried to escape Lyon as soon as I could. And I did a lot of different things. I lived in communes. I was a shepherdess. I've been a truck driver. I worked in factories. And I went around, and then after I began to work in tourism, and I lived in Mexico, in China, and in Egypt. And after that, in fact, I met my husband in the Philippines.
Okay.
So that was my link to come back to New York. And we settled in New York very, very long time ago.
Right. Yeah. And when was that? What year?
I can't remember the year, but it was probably in the around 85.
Okay.
Or,
uh-huh.
A while ago.
Right. Okay. And where did you get interested in paper?
When I was traveling, sometimes I was completely, I don't know if it's in traveling or other places. But anyway, when I had problem to communicate with people, I had the tendency to draw.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my therapy. When I couldn't deal with the world, I was kind of drawing and doing my things. And then after in New York, I worked in tourism. I was a tour guide, and I began to get bored finding all. And I was also guiding in China as a tour leader, taking American and French people in China. But I began to get bored with all this traveling and going around the world. And I wanted to try to become an artist full time. So that was just a decision to say, okay, now I'm going to try that, and I'm going to try it 200%. And I wanted to have something that was cheap and easy, and that I could just concentrate on the process of developing a style.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I wanted to do illustration, because it felt like anybody can do illustration for anything. And slowly, I would develop something a little more substantial to do something else. Of course, it didn't really work as planned. So illustration were really tough to to get any assignment for illustrations. I got some. Mm-hmm. I did the cover program for Stage Bill, different ones for Chicago, San Francisco, and New York.
And those were those drawn illustrations or paper cut?
No, paper cut.
Okay.
Yeah, paper cut, because I just decided paper cut was easier and I could change. I just cut all my elements, and if the art director don't like the red background, I can put a blue background so I don't have to redo everything, and then I can, you know, understand better composition. So I started with paper cut because I was painting, I'm not really good at it, and then after I don't clean my brush so they get dry and it's expensive.
Right. And so do you think you saw the paper cuts in China and other places?
I saw them everywhere. I saw them in Mexico. I saw them in China. I didn't specially pay attention, but it was definitely everywhere I was looking at things. I was, definitely. So,
right. And you don't have any training. Is that correct?
I did about one year and a half in Beaux-Arts in Lyon. But it was a school of art, but it was too academic. Mm-hmm. And it was too centered on the art world. Mm-hmm. It was not inclusive enough of everybody, and it was, I find it a little too restrictive on who has access to art and who can make art.
Right.
Intelligentsia, and I didn't like that approach.
Uh-huh. And you, but the paper cutting, do you have any training in paper cutting?
No.
No.
No. I just started cutting.
Right. And, so that's really interesting. So you were trying to get illustration jobs, and you did get some. Mm-hmm. And what kind of papers were you using back then? This was the 80s,
magazine 90s. Paper, mm-hmm. Canson paper, mm-hmm. any paper I could find that had the color I was looking for.
Right. Okay, and I think I met you, it must have been the early 90s, at the Center for Book Arts. Mm-hmm. We were both living in New York and did some sort of event there, maybe a sale or something. And you, so how did you get to the Center for Book Arts? And
I was putting together a portfolio to show my illustration. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine said, "Oh, you're doing artist book." I was like, "What is artist book?"
Right.
Because I didn't want to use the plastic sleeves like everybody was using. I said, "What's the point to do art if you just put things under plastic? It looks completely like it doesn't have a feeling, doesn't have a story." So I started to make my illustration in books. And she told me, "Oh, there is a center for book art. You should show what you do." So I went there and I showed. So at that time I had my portfolios. And then I also started to print at Bob Blackburn Workshop because I was also trying to put my work anywhere I could. And somebody say, "Oh, there is this competition or something, exhibition for prints." And I said, "Okay, I'll do prints." So I was like, "Okay, how you do print?" And I had a friend who was at Bob Blackburn, so she told me linocut was easier. And I tried, and I was like, "Oh, that's hard. I'm just going to do paper cutting, and I'm going to ink it and print it." So I did like that the 36 views of the Empire State Building. And then after, because I want to keep all my stories and I like to have everything together, so I began to put my 36 plates with haikus from, I was looking for haikus to go because it was the 36 views of Mount Fuji and it was also the 36 views of the Eiffel Tower. And I wanted to have all my pleats together with haikus. And then I brought that also to the Center for Book Art. Mm. I didn't know it was an artist book. For me, it was to have everything in one place. And then, so it was Brian at the time. So Brian asked me to, he said, okay, can we use some of your illustration for the catalog? And in exchange, you'll have a class. And I said, sure. And he said, oh, and your 36 views, it should be in that coming show. And I can't remember the name of the show, but anyway, I put it there, and my book was on the show. So I got a book in a show at an exhibition at Center for Book Art before I had my first class in What is an Artist Book? And my first class was Barbara Moriello.
Oh, yeah.
And she still remember, and I still remember when I arrive in the class, I say, I don't do straight lines. I don't use a ruler. And she told me, no problem, we won't use a ruler, and you don't need to make straight lines. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, I took classes with Barbara too. She's great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was a great, great, great introduction. I still don't know what's an artist book, but that's another question.
Right, and on your website, I was just looking at your... Do you call it books or artist books as the header on your website? And you have over 100. I mean, all these little pictures that you can click on and see your artist books. So listeners should definitely go to the website and look at Beatrice's amazing works. Yeah, so you do so many different things. Let's see. I want to talk about... how you got into getting your work fabricated in other materials. So how did that start?
Well, it's all about want to live from making art.
Yes.
So the illustration got some job, not enough really to stay alive.
Right.
Then after, with the Center for Book Art, I started to sell some of my artist books. Not completely enough to stay around. So I was always looking to a way to exhibit, do anything that I can keep on creating and stay in that world. In fact, I still do, you know. It didn't change it's much from that time. Right. But I'm just adding more things. But it's still the same. It's like create. Find a way to sell it
right.
in one form or another that you can keep on creating your stories. So I was always looking for anything I can do for free. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, you see image on at Barnes & Noble's on the cafe and you say, oh, you can put art here. Let's try to see who you contact to ask if I can have an exhibition there. You know, so I'm still doing that all the time. Mm-hmm. And after I began to make my website, and I find also that you could have call for artists. So I began to Google call for artists. I even don't know if I was on Google or something else. But I began to look, I find public art call for artists. Mm-hmm. And that was free to apply. Mm-hmm. You know, so because I was applying to any exhibition, to anything, if it was free to apply. And I still do.
Yeah.
So for the public art, I was like, oh, that's interesting. And they were asking for sculpture or this or that. And it's the same approach I used from going from paper cut to printing, you know, and to find out that putting things together are artist books. I was like, oh, if you have two pages and they are on, and it was in fact my first public art, it's like an open book because it's just two pieces of metal that are planted on an outside. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, so then that's an artist book, but that's public art. So cutting from one piece, it can be any kind of material. And that started to tell me that most of the category, as usual, it's more in our heads, but there is no difference between a book in a library or a book in public art.
Right, right.
That outside, it's just a surface that tells stories. So the way you find the in and the out. So, and it didn't change. I'm still on the same thing, still trying to open my mind from 2D to 3D and try to unlimit the way I'm thinking about some approach, saying, well, you see it like that, but it could be another way. So it's still the same path I took at the beginning. I'm still on it.
Right. So you're looking at calls for artists and you're picking the ones that you can envision a piece of yours mm-hmm. replicated. So tell me about one of the ones in New York. One of
not
your
really. I mean, when I look at call for artists, it's not so much applying what I have. It's more imagining what I would like to see. Mm-hmm. You know, if I was in an airport or in a...
Right.
It's like, what if... Oh, it would be cool if it was this or that. You know, I'm trying to stretch my mind to see and to see it outside of what I can do. Because that's the way I can learn something new and can stretch how to do it. But it's a gap. It's a gap on because sometimes I don't apply to things, say, oh, no, that I cannot do. And then after I have to say, oh, let's say you can do it. Mm-hmm. You know, so I apply to different things who are the stretch. The only one I don't apply is memorials. I don't like memorials.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that when I see memorials, I'm like, no, not for me. I'm for going on.
Right. So tell me about one of your public art pieces and sort of how that developed. And I'm curious whether, because now I'm sure you do a lot on the computer. Nothing happens in paper. No paper cutting, but
yes.
What do you still do it with paper cutting, yeah. And then you do computer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, because I mean, it's like illustration. It's like art. It's like everything. Sometimes you begin to have an assignment, something you want to do, and you see that there are some part that will repeat, and or about scale, you're not sure. So my last artist book about 100 zebras, in fact, I started it from the computer because I was not sure at what scale I want to make the zebras. And I still made 3 books, but I'm not sure I'm not going to make another book in another scale later with another composition. You know, so sometimes you're like, oh, that will save me a lot of time if I start from the computer because I can flip and cut and paste and repeat and put the thing so I can see the composition and then I can rearrange. And then after I sometimes try on the computer and I cannot start because my lines are dead. Mm-hmm. There is not something, it doesn't go further. So I have to go back to a cutting.
Mm-hmm.
And with the cutting, sometimes I begin, because of course, when I'm doing something, I have no idea where I'm going. So I just have to start and get a feeling that I recognize something where I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just seeing what I made that I can see, oh, that's something. There is something in that line or in that whatever. But so I don't have a recipe. I try and then after sometimes it's dead ends and I have to go back another way. I don't know how it works.
Right. And that's making me think of your, I've seen you working on these very long pieces mm-hmm. of rolled, is it Tyvek usually?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that all that you cut on now?
Or depends.
Primarily?
Depends. Because I cut Tyvek. Yeah, that's my first, because I have a lot of rolls.
Mm-hmm.
And so I cut Tyvek. But if I do an artist book and I need a little more structure, then it will be Arsha's cover.
Okay.
I like Arsha's cover, how soft it is when you cut it. And it still has a body to stay and has a structure without doing too much to it. I mean, depends on the scale and the holes.
Right, right.
And then sometimes if it's for, because for public art, it's also nice to have a model in paper.
Right.
Because you can do it on computer, but it's not like the same as just making it and then looking how it looks with the sun, with, mm-hmm. you know, the shadow, and you can move it. And then after you can take that picture and then scale it and put it on the computer and put people next to it to see
right.
how it is. And sometimes I will remake the full size cutting put on my wall.
Mm-hmm.
So then I can see how it feels to be in front of the drawing.
Right.
You know, and maybe some details I'm like, oh, it will be at kids level or at adult level. It's not nice, you know.
Right,
it's like
right.
let's change the thing. So it's no recipe. Each project developed in its own way.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And you work primarily in black and white. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Because there is rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
There is so many things in silhouettes, and it's so dreamy mm-hmm. to imagine, and it can be any color. And I'm still working on the line and the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe one day if I grow up, I can use colors.
Yeah, no, it's fast. It's fabulous. Your black and white is very striking, the silhouette, as you say. And what about cutting tools? What do you cut?
Just the X-Acto knife.
Just yeah. the regular number 11?
11. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, every time I can see something to buy that has another blade, and I will do it, or another handle. But at the end, it's back to the regular Blade
yeah.
11.
I find that too. I've tried all the other ones, but I just like the one, the number 11. That's it.
Yeah. So I'm really basic. And because I find it liberating to have very simple material and tools. So like that, I can put more my energy on looking at the line, looking at the rhythm, and
right.
finding a little more on that subject. And it's so, yeah, there is so much happening. Because sometimes you can look at the negative, but then after you look at the positive, and it's completely, mm-hmm. and from 2D to 3D, it's also fascinating.
Yeah, and the light and shadow.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I can see there's just so many nuances. And do you ever draw what you're going to cut or print out what you're going to cut?
Yes.
Yes.
So it depends also what it's for.
Mm-hmm.
If it's for a commission, if I tell the life of the people or... I will have different elements, and then I sometimes will just put them on the computer to make different composition to give a mm-hmm. Choice.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I will make, for any commission, I will make a very, very tight drawing.
Right. So and what would an example commission be? Like a wedding portrait or...
Yeah, I mean, wedding portrait, a birthday, or people want an anniversary where they have all memories, or a family, for
right,
a family,
right.
where you have all the memory of the family, or for a company to have the story and the mission of the company, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. school, like I did in a Chinese International School in Hong Kong. All the memories of space and
right.
what people did and what are the landmark of their history. So it can be a family, it can be a company,
right.
a school.
And so in that case, you do a tight drawing. So they...
Very tight drawing. So everybody can, you know, there is just liner of all the holes that they can see exactly. And sometimes I even can make a mock-up of what it will look in black or in metal or in wood or something. So it gives an idea exactly of what they will get, because when you cut, it's cut. Right. If it's for pieces I do but for me, for the studio, or for putting on the fire when they burn me, because my parents always say, "Oh, what, you know, say, what are you working on?" And I say something and say, "Oh, what, who are you doing that for? What it's for?" And I'm always saying, "It's for the fire when they burn me." Not a good reason. So if it's for the fire, then I have a lot of very, very loose line that I do as action painting, you know, very large things with line of, I call them line of energy. So I have a million of them. It's very confusing. You have no idea what's going to happen. And when I begin to cut, I cut and I have no idea what it will look like. And it's a really therapeutic.
Yeah, I bet.
That's how I made my latest cutting, which is my Enigma Coronada, which I call her. I call her because I have no idea how it was going to come, because it's really an insect and all that, and a virus. And it looks so much religious. I didn't know I had so much religion inside me. So after I had say, oh, I have to call her Our Lady of Confinement.
Yeah, I see her behind you, and I see what you mean.
So it's a surprise, because so it's a series I started, and there are like fashion bugs. Because before I did Fashion Warriors, exploring different costumes and women's power and women's mythology. And then after I thought it was finished, the series, and I was like, no, I want to do, and my first was Coleoptera Cleopatra. And I still had this urge with the virus and with all those cells and all that. I felt like I was not finished. And I said, no, I have to make a new series. So it's fashion bugs and viruses.
Fashion bugs and viruses. Cool.
So I'm exploring that. And I have no idea what I'm cutting when I'm cutting that. It's exploration. And when I see them, I'm like, wow, that's what I have inside.
Right.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about The Paper Studio, my free Facebook group that has been evolving over the past several years. I'm re-energizing it in 2020 to include a monthly paper challenge. It's also a place to share what you're working on, get encouragement when you need a little push, be inspired with new ideas, tips, and tricks, all having to do with paper, of course. Join us by going to Facebook and searching for the group, The Paper Studio. Now back to the episode.
Tell me about a favorite or a recent public art project.
The subway, well, I have two that I really like. There is a subway station in Cleveland that's called Soundsbite, and I like it because it's about the food and music festival that people around that neighborhood have.
Soundbites,
because there is vines and there are circles that are printed on glass.
Okay.
So I like the way there is a color element and there is the cut stainless steel. So that was really interesting.
Wait. So you just said printed on glass, but also stainless steel. So
yes.
What is the stainless steel?
The vine, it's the stainless steel, because it's, in fact, it's an over... It's a bridge.
Okay.
It's a bridge, and under the bridge you have the tracks going on each direction.
Okay.
So it's a barrier. It's a fence.
Okay.
So the stainless steel is the fence, and inside the fence you have round printed glass that are like little bubbles of stories going on. And the other one I like, in fact, it's the two last projects, so maybe it's a direction, two different directions it's going on. It's the one for Asheville in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And it's victory column. Mm-hmm. I mean, in French, they call them victoire. It's a round column.
Yeah.
I mean, columns are round.
Yeah.
It can be square, but yeah. Anyway. And I'm speaking with my hands because I have a hard time to describe it with words. And it's Lexington Street in, they call it Lexington Avenue, but it's really narrow and they don't have a lot of boardwalk. And they wanted to celebrate the little business there, because at one point they wanted to take out all that street and make a giant mall. And the people succeeded a neighborhood association to make all the little funky and the quirky little shops who have a record company or brewers or tattoo parlors or little people who make their own clothes or tea. Mm-hmm. And they all have a bookstore. And they all have this little business who resisted the big mall, mm-hmm. and have a real life in that street.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was voted one of the best streets in the States. I don't remember which award, but uh-huh. So I want to celebrate that with a victory. So on the top, it's like a tattoo. But it's like a Dorje, like the Tibetan sign of going upward. And it's like two hearts. So I like the symbols of going up. And it was really interesting to go also from 2D to 3D, because in that column, you have also circles of each individual shops that are a little tilted. So it makes a lot of different angle of view. And it's in a very, very narrow spot.
And this is it cut metal?
It's cut stainless steel, yes.
Stainless steel, okay.
Yeah. So yeah, it would have been great if it could have moved the angle panel, but that's a security issue.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, you think about it 1 second, you say no. And color with glass inclusion, but budget, no. Right. So, you know.
So I want to hear how that project started. So what was your proposal?
My proposal was exactly that, mm-hmm. The victory column.
Was it a computer rendering? Was it paper?
Oh, I did, how that one worked. I can't remember if we were... It was probably intention, and we were four or five finalists. Mm-hmm. So when I was finalist, so we didn't have to put a proposal first.
Okay.
It's when we get to the four or five finalists.
So first you just show your work.
Yeah, and say your letter of interest, why you want to do something for that city.
Yeah.
So from that, we were four or five to be selected to be finalists. And then after, that's when you have to do it like if it's for real.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, only one of the five will get it, which is like...
But does everybody get paid something for that?
Yeah, I don't remember what it is. It's always written in the call for artists, but it's always ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, it's like $500 or so, and you're going to spend a whole month on it.
You put all your time into it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And sometimes you even have to go there, you know, so mm-hmm. to get your plane ticket to get there for the competition or for, so it's always, don't think about the money.
Right. Yeah. That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you have to really mobilize yourself like you're going to have it. Because mm-hmm. when you spend that much time, that much energy on something, and as soon as you got the interview or send the thing, you have to believe you don't have it, because otherwise you get killed when you don't have it. And, you know, it's only one on five that will have it. So that's terrible. I wish it was another system, because it's a grueling system.
Yeah.
And so
what did you prepare?
So I did my, I wanted to make a victory because it was about the space they had. It was impossible to put anything that was meaningful in that space. Mm-hmm. And I did it in paper. Mm-hmm. Then I fold my paper and did my idea. I don't remember how many hours or days or weeks I spent on that. But anyway, I got to that point where I had my paper model. And then after I made a rendering on the computer, I took the picture of my paper model and put it on the computer to see how it looks on real life at the scale and with people and with shadows and all that. And then after I was sure I wanted to do that, so in fact, I went a step further and I did a 3D printed model because I was going to go to the interview and I was like, oh, that's going to be impressive to just give them to the jury, say, hold it, you know, that's the piece. So that's what I did.
Cool. And you got it.
And I got it. So something worked.
And so how long was the whole process from
So in fact, this one was, I can't remember, but I think it was probably 1 year or something.
A year.
Yeah, it was long because they wanted the people to... people from the city to say which one they wanted. So I got chosen by the people of the city. But somehow they said it was not exactly what they wanted, so they wanted to start again the competition with the same people. And so we went back into the process. So it was like terrible.
Yeah.
And then I got chosen again at the end.
Okay. And then for the fabrication, you have to work with the fabricator?
Yes. When you apply to something, you just say you're going to do that thing for that. I mean, the city say we want something for that price.
Right.
So usually I call the fabricator before I make my paper model and saying, if I want to do something that would be this dimension, do you think it's possible with this budget?
Right.
You know, if he tells me no way, okay, I try to scale back, or, you know, or I ask, do you have any idea? Or,
right. And do
so
you
that, works that way? Yeah.
Do you have fabricators you work with, or do you have to work with like the city's fabricator?
Depends on the project.
Depends, right?
Yeah, sometimes they have the fabricator and you have to work with, because if they have a lot of projects with the same material, they probably have a better price if they deal with like 10 art projects with the same thing. I know that happened for the subway in New York that was in faceted glass, because they did maybe 10 stations with faceted glass.
So
it was better for the city. I mean, it was not the city, it was the MTA. To negotiate to have all the artists going to the same fabricator.
Right.
But then after, for me, I have fabricator I love to work with, but then they are located more around New York.
Right.
So if I have, so I had a project in Washington State. So it was, it was not a huge budget, so I couldn't do it with my fabricator because after with the shipping and bringing the things, and we couldn't do it. So I chose somebody who was near there. And sometimes it will be the city is used to work with one fabricator. So I don't want to rock the boat, you know, if I don't want to choose one and it's something, of course, each project, it's always different. So you're never completely 100% right. know how it's going to go out. So, and every time you want to do something a little different and a little special, and if they prefer to be with somebody, I'm like, sure, I'm not, you know, I'm not going to push my fabricator and then after we have another problem on the line and you never know where it's coming from.
Right, right. Yeah. Cool. Okay, let's switch gears because I know you've given several TED Talks. And I want to hear a little bit about that. What was the first one?
And the first one was the one in 2011, the big TED Talk.
Yeah.
It's probably my only big TED Talk because, you know, you speak. I mean, it's not really a platform where you have a lot of artists.
Right.
So you really say how you came to do paper cutting and cut stories. So once you said it once, you know, I'm not a motivator speaker that will have another book in 2 years with another approach.
Right, right. So how did you get invited to do that?
Because I always say yes to everything that's happening.
Uh-huh.
So I was invited by the Alliance Française in New York. And it's always a chain of events because it was about the Museum of Art and Design.
Okay.
When it was still on 53rd Street and they had the Extreme Lace exhibition.
Okay.
And I thought it was genius. And when I left that exhibition, I said, who was the curator? And they gave me the name. And then after I made a file about my work and about other paper cutters, and I sent to the curator saying, I think it was so great with the lace. I think there is a connection.
Uh-huh.
And that led me to the Slash Show. So we decided to make the Slash Show. And it was David McFadden. And then
and Slash was at the new location. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so I was consultant artist on the exhibition. Mm-hmm. I was artist in residence, and they gave me a choice on where I wanted to have my work in the show. So I chose the two floors, of course.
Yeah.
And I cut the piece at the museum. So that put me in on site for Alliance Française, who find I was French and I did that. So they invited me to do a talk at Alliance Française.
Uh-huh.
So I went to do the talk at Alliance Française. And at the end of the talk, a woman came to me and said, oh, I would love you to talk at TED. Would you be interested? I said, sure. I said, you know what TED is? I said, no. So she gave me her card and that was it. And then I began to look online. And I was like, oh, that's big. And I only looked a little, maybe a 2 minutes into a presentation. I said, okay, stop looking.
Right.
And 1 week after, she contacted me and saying, okay, are you on? And I was for the 8 months later, I was for going in, it was in California at that time,
right,
for the talk. So I prepared like crazy.
And do they help you at all with the presentation?
They first let you do whatever you think.
Uh-huh.
And then after maybe 2 months before, 1 month before, they want your, no, maybe even 2-3 months anyway. They want your presentation, mm-hmm, and then they help you. So first I was making my photographs myself and they were not good enough.
Uh-huh.
So they sent me a photographer at my studio, which was great.
Yeah.
I still use it now. That was fantastic.
Good contact. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And then after they had also somebody who kind of unified my slides to make the same background and to make some transition, but very, very small adjustment.
Uh-huh.
And then when you are, when I was in California, we had a rehearsal and then they make some remark, but it was, it's a little too late and,
yeah,
you know, so it's, it was more stressing than anything.
Yeah, for me, I would imagine.
Than to have that, because I already rehearsed everywhere. I could have cut my head. I could still say the next line. So then to tell me things, it was too late. I did do some changes, but it was so stressing for me to be on those big talks. Yeah.
Oh yeah, but you wore a beautiful cape.
Yes.
Was it a cape? A
yeah, because
cape.
In fact, that has been the first thing I did.
Uh-huh.
Because when I began to say, oh, I have to be on a stage and there is like 2,000 or 3,000 people
right
on the other side, what am I going to wear?
It right.
is the first question, what am I going to look like? And I was, so that the first things I thought, it was like, it's not about you, it's about your work. So mm-hmm. in fact, you have to have your work walk on stage, not your face. Mm-hmm. And I was like, good idea. I'm going to make something that protects me completely.
Yeah.
In fact, now I think I would make a mask. But it was the first things I needed to have. And I thought about that magic cape, Superman, you know.
Uh-huh.
You
yeah.
have superpowers, so right. you write the cape and it's your work. And so I spent a lot of time making that cape because there is no repetition.
Mm-hmm.
It was like meditation and thinking about what I want to speak about, what's important to me.
Yeah.
And try to cut all this ego thing, which I didn't succeed completely, but anyway, it's the direction I wanted to go.
Right. Well, it's fantastic, and we'll put a link in the show notes so people can take a look at your cape and your presentation. Yeah, you just said something that made me think I wanted to ask you about whether you ever fold and cut paper, or are you always working like it on a canvas?
Yeah, I always work.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, because the fold doesn't really work with Tyvek.
Right.
You cannot erase the fold.
Right, right.
And I don't like symmetry. It's
mm-hmm.
too rigid.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes for exercise or something like that, I would do symmetry, but then after I will kill the symmetry.
Mm-hmm. Right. You'll cut into it more or change
yeah.
it. Yeah. Yeah,
to change it. And sometimes I bought like the Japanese punch maker.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I want to have little circle and I will try to use it and it jumps at me. It's just like one perfect circle in all other lines that are alive. And I'm like, that circle don't belong to my paper
right.
cutting.
Right. Oh. Oh.
I made also an illustration with a compass that I bought. It was for Stage B a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't really control my circle, even to be completely circle, and it was good.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot make straight line, and I cannot make circles.
Yeah, we're coming up. This is a theme. Okay, and let's just touch on your teaching. You teach quite a bit.
Yes, I enjoy teaching because it gets me out of the studio.
Right.
And I love meeting people and mm-hmm. seeing how they approach the paper cutting.
Right.
So it's paper cutting, everybody knows it because everybody right. cuts things every day.
Yeah.
So it's revealing things people already know
mm-hmm.
and seeing different approaches.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting. And yeah. it's always the same class, and it's never the same class because it's never the same people.
Right. right.
So I really flow in the classes with what people want and what people do or what their fantasy about cutting.
Mm-hmm.
And I challenge them to do another way of seeing about looking at it. And I really enjoy. And that's why with this pandemia, the idea of teaching online, I went completely I was like, okay, that's the new reality I have to learn. And I really had a headache. And then I tried to predict everything. And there is so much bifurcation when I'm teaching by just seeing people. And then when you have people in a class, you just see the body, how people react against something that they don't get or they cannot understand, or there is so many communication that are not by just seeing or just by, it's just by feeling, by having people in the same space. And so by the time you air that, we'll know if I have another class. No, because right now I'm going to make a Center for Book Art class in May that I call Paper Cut Exploration, and it's for 2 hours. And
it's online.
Yeah.
It's live online. Yeah.
It's live online, yes. And I did put a limit because I still want to see the hands and how people do the same. And
that makes
sense. I have no, I called it experimentation because more than the paper cutting will be the teaching experimentation.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be great. So
it might be interesting, but it will be something different.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy seeing other cities and other states, and a lot of places we go for teaching, it's not that there is a major tourist attraction that you would go there.
Right.
And it's so interesting because every time there is a lot of things to discover, a lot of just the taste of the place and what they are cooking, what the air smells like, what's the parks, their public art. I love it.
Yeah.
So I really do it to connect with other people.
Right. And you're teaching at all of the places like Aeromont, Penland, Haystack, places like that. And then in New York at the Center for Book Arts. And I think you do a lot at the 92nd Street Y.
Yes. Yes. Y, and I'm really open. I'm having
and we're gonna
will
talk
travel.
About having you come to Colorado too.
I would love to, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so let's wrap up. This has been really fun, but tell me about doing the cover art for the Dave Matthews Band album.
That's another perk of having the TED Talk.
Okay.
Is that people find you through the TED Talk and you receive an email. And I was not here in the 70s or 80s, so I never heard of Dave Matthews, and it was great. Uh-huh. It was great. The person who was the art director was fantastic. And then they invited me for a concert.
Oh,
so I went to the concert in New York with a super VIP pass and you can go backstage, and it was fantastic. It was really a great, great experience, and he's super, super nice.
Right.
Really a fantastic person. I mean, I kind of saw that from looking online at all the social programs he makes and all that. And I was not that attracted to the music by itself, but his charisma and the intention, and it was great. And then after to just have been to a concert and see the whole thing, when you see the people, you have some people that they follow him everywhere.
Yeah, I bet.
He has really a lot of fans. Very, very dedicated. And it was nice. It was really nice to see.
And what about the project itself? Did the art director have a really direct assignment for you?
Yes.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah, because they were on a time frame. Mm-hmm. And so she chose something I already made.
Okay.
But then I adapted and then after she gave me another assignment because I did another cover for a compilation. And she's fantastic because she's very precise of what she wants. And then after, when there is modification, she really knows what works and what doesn't work for her and for the public and for what she wants. So it's really, it was real pleasure.
Mm,
and at the same time, I had another assignment with a client I won't name. Big corporations, and who was exactly the opposite.
I'm sure that happened. Yeah.
So it was interesting to have the both, you know, because when you start a project, you never know.
Right. Wow.
You never know.
Well, this has been really fun, Beatrice. Tell us where we can find you online.
At beatricecoron.com.
Okay. Yeah, and you have an email list, I think, for that people can keep up in touch with you. And
I'm trying to make my email like 3-4 times a year. I'm not that great with social media.
Okay.
But I'm trying.
I see you on Facebook. You're on Facebook.
Yes, I'm a little dry. I just put my paper cut and I just put the title on it. But I don't really know how to do it another way.
Right. Well, fantastic. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.